Lecture 7 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner, Human Values in Education, entitled The Temperaments and the Human Organism, given July 23, 1924. The lectures given here have described an art of education based on knowledge of the human being, and at this point you may have a clear idea of the ideal relationship between the teachers and students. The soul, life, and personality of teachers affect the students in hundreds of unseen ways, but this is ineffective unless a penetrating knowledge of the human being lives within the teacher's souls, a kind of knowledge that borders on spiritual experience. And because there are so many mistaken ideas about what, quote, spiritual experience, unquote, actually is, I need to precede my lecture with a few comments to clarify what this means in an anthroposophic sense. First, it is easy to imagine that spiritual perception must rise above all that is material. Certainly, we can have a deeply satisfying soul experience by rising above the material and ascending into the spiritual world, although this may be colored by a feeling of egoism. We must do this because we cannot become familiar with the spiritual unless we gain knowledge of the spirit world, and spiritual science must deal in many ways with spirit realms and beings that are unrelated to the physical sensory world. And when it comes to understanding what modern humankind so urgently needs to know about the actual suprasensory human life before birth or conception and the life after death, then we must rise to body-free suprasensory supra-physical perception. But of course, we must also act and work and stand firmly in this physical world. For example, teachers are not asked to teach disembodied souls. If we want to be teachers, we do not inquire about our relationship to souls who have died and now live in the spirit world. Rather, to work as teachers between birth and death, we must inquire about how a soul lives in the physical body. We must indeed consider this, at least for the years immediately after birth. It is really a matter of being able to look with spirit into the physical. Indeed, spiritual science is primarily a matter of investigating the material world through spirit. But the opposite process is also correct. We must use spiritual vision to penetrate the spirit world, to the degree that the spiritual seems to be as full of the, quote, sap of life, unquote, as anything in the sensory world. We must be able to speak of the spirit world as if it radiated colors, as if it sounds, as if its sounds could be heard, as if it were just as embodied as beings in the sensory world. In anthroposophy, it is mainly this that annoys abstract philosophers so much. They find it very irritating that spiritual investigators describe the world of spirit beings as if one might meet such beings at any moment, just as we might meet a person, as if one might hold out a hand to them or speak with them. Spiritual researchers describe spirit beings as though they were physical beings, and indeed their description makes such beings seem almost earthly. In other words, they portray the spirit in pictures that the senses can comprehend. They do so with full consciousness, because to them spirit is absolutely real. And there is some truth in all this, because real knowledge of the whole leads us to the point where it is possible to give one's hand to spirit beings, so to speak. One can meet and speak with them. This strikes philosophers as paradoxical because they can conceive of the spirit world only through abstract ideas. Nevertheless, such descriptions are needed. On the other hand, it is also necessary to, quote-unquote, see through human beings so that the material aspect vanishes completely and only pure spirit remains. But if one who is not an anthroposophist wants to view human beings as spirit, they become not just a ghost, but much less. Human beings become, quote, hangers, unquote, on which all sorts of concepts are hung in order to generate mental images and such. By comparison, a ghost is fairly solid, but a human being described by philosophers is really indecently naked when it comes to spirit. Spiritual science sees physical human beings with purely spiritual perception, but they nevertheless retain their brains, liver, lungs, and so on. They are concrete human beings, having everything that one might find when a body is dissected. Everything that is spiritual in nature works right into the physical. The physical is observed spiritually, but human beings nevertheless have a physical body. Spiritual reality goes so far that one can even blow one's nose in a spiritual sense. The only way to bring the physical and spiritual together is by contemplating the physical in such a way that it can become completely spiritual, and by contemplating spirit so that it becomes almost physical. The physical human being can be contemplated in a state of health or illness, but the perceptible material vanishes and becomes spirit. And spirit can be contemplated as it exists between death and rebirth. In the sense of an image, it becomes physical. Thus the two are brought together. There are two possibilities for learning to penetrate actual human beings: the possibility of seeing spirit through the use of sensory images, and the possibility of seeing actual spiritual entities within the sensory world. If one asks how to understand spirit vision in the true sense, we can say that we must learn to see everything related to the senses in a spiritual way, and we must view spirit in a way that is similar to the way in which we use our senses. This seems odd, but it is true. And you cannot view children in the right way until you have penetrated what I just said and have released its truth. Let me give you an example. Child in my class is growing pale, and I notice an increasing pallor manifesting in the physical life of the girl. But we gain nothing by going to a doctor and getting some prescription to restore the child's color. We could call the school doctor, who comes and prescribes something to restore her lost color. But even if the doctor has done absolutely the right thing and prescribed the correct remedy, we may observe something strange in this quote-unquote cured child. In a certain sense, of course, she is cured. We could even call someone with the knowledge of a doctor to write a testimonial for the authorities, and it would probably be said that the doctor had cured the child. Later on, however, we will notice that the cured child can no longer absorb things properly. She is fidgety and restless and cannot pay attention. Previously, she sat quietly in her place, pale and a bit slow, but now she begins to hit her neighbor. Previously, she would dip her pen gently into the ink, but now she does it with such force that the ink splatters her exercise book. The doctor acted properly, but the result was not beneficial. Sometimes people who have been cured suffer later on from extraordinary effects. Again, in such cases, it is important to recognize the source of the problem. When teachers are able to penetrate the spiritual cause of an outer physical expression, such as pallor, they realize, for example, that the power of memory, acting in the soul, is really a transformed growth force. And to develop the forces of growth and nourishment is exactly the same on a lower level as it is to cultivate the power of memory. It is the same force, but at a different stage of metamorphosis. Pictured systematically, we can say that during the first years of a child's life, these two forces are merged and have not yet separated. Later, memory separates from this fused condition, and it becomes an independent force. The same is true of the forces of growth and nourishment. Small children still need those forces that later become memory, so that the stomach can function and digest milk. This is why they are unable to remember things. Later, when the power of memory no longer serves the stomach, when the stomach makes fewer demands and retains only a minimum of those forces, then part of the growth forces are transformed into the soul quality of memory. The other children in the class may be more robust, and the division between their powers of memory and growth may be better balanced. Consequently, the teacher pays less attention to a child who has little to fall back on in this sense. If this is the case, it may happen that the child's power of memory is overtaxed, with too much demanded of that liberated faculty. So the child becomes pale, and the teacher must recognize what has happened because too much strain has been placed on the child's memory. And the color returns when such a child is relieved of this burden. But teachers must understand that a growing pallor is connected with what they have done by overburdening the child's memory. It is important to see right into physical symptoms and to recognize that when a child grows too pale, it is because the memory has been overtaxed. And I may have another child in the class who occasionally becomes very red in the face, and this too may be a cause for concern. When a feverish red flush appears, it is easy to see certain parallel conditions in the child's soul life. In the strangest way, when we would least expect it, such children become passionately angry and overly emotional. Naturally, one could do the same as before. Something may be prescribed for a rush of blood to the head. In these cases, too, a doctor's duty is performed. But it is important to recognize that, in contrast to the other, this child's memory has been neglected. The forces of memory have gone too much into the forces of growth and nourishment. Here we must try to require more of the child's memory. If we do this, the symptoms will disappear. Unless we consider the physical and spiritual together, there are many matters in a school that we will not recognize as needing adjustment. We can train ourselves to see this interrelationship of body and spirit by looking at the temperaments which lies between them as part of the human organization as a whole. Children come to school and they have four temperaments, varied, of course, with all kinds of transitions and mixes. These temperaments are called melancholic, phlegmatic, sanguine, and choleric. In Waldorf education, we greatly value the ability to enter and understand children according to their temperaments. We actually arrange the classroom seating on this basis. For example, we try to determine which children are choleric and place them together. Thus, the teachers know that one corner contains all the children who tend to be choleric. In another, the phlegmatic children are seated. Somewhere in the middle are the sanguines, and somewhere else the melancholics are in a group. This method of grouping has great advantages. Experience shows that after a while the phlegmatics become so bored with sitting together that to get rid of their boredom they begin to interact. Cholerics, on the other hand, beat up on one another, and this too quickly improves. It is the same for the fidgety sanguines, and the melancholics get to see what it is like when others are absorbed in melancholy. Handling children in this way allows one to see how like reacts favorably to like. This is true even from an external point of view, apart from the fact that it allows teachers to survey the whole class much more easily because the children of similar temperaments are seated together. And now we come to the essential point. Teachers must go deeply into the nature of the human being that they are able to deal in a truly practical way with cholerics, sanguines, and melancholics. Naturally, there will be times when it is necessary to build a bridge, as I mentioned, between the school and the home. And this must be done in a friendly, tactful way. Imagine that I have a melancholic boy in class, and I can barely do anything with him. I am unable to go into his difficulties in the right way. He broods and withdraws. He is self-occupied and pays no attention to what is going on in class. If one applies educational methods that are not based on knowledge of the human being, one might think that we should do everything possible to get his attention and draw him out. In general, however, this will only make things worse. The child will brood even more. All such cures which arise from superficial thinking are of little help. The best help in such cases is the spontaneous love that the teacher feels for the child, because this arouses an awareness of sympathy and stirs the child's subconscious. It is certain that all forms of appeal are not just wasted effort, but actually harm the child, who becomes more melancholic than before. In class, it helps greatly to enter the melancholy, discover its tendencies, and show interest in the child's mental attitude. In a sense, the teacher becomes melancholic with the melancholic child. As teachers, we must carry all four temperaments in harmonious, balanced activity. And this balance, which directly contradicts the child's melancholy, is perceived by the child if it is continued and always present in relationship between teacher and child. Children see the kind of person their teacher is by sensing what lies behind the teacher's words. In this way, sneaking in behind this accepted mask of melancholy, the teacher's loving sympathy is implanted in the child. This can be of great help to the class, in the class. Now we will take this even further. We must recognize that every manifestation of human melancholy is related to some irregularity in the liver function. This may seem unlikely to a physiologist, but it is true that every kind of melancholy, especially when it becomes a pathology, is a result of some irregularity of this kind. In such cases, I turn to the child's parents and tell them to put more sugar than usual into the child's food. Sweet things and sugar help to regulate the liver function. By advising a mother to give her child more sugar, the school and home work together to lift the child's melancholy out of a pathological condition, and I create the possibility of finding the right constitutional treatment. Or I may have a sanguine girl who goes from one impression to another. She always wants what comes next, always before she has grasped what precedes it. She starts out strong and shows great interest in everything, but interest soon fades. Such a child is generally fair rather than dark, so I am faced with the problem of how to deal with her at school. Whenever I do anything with her, I try to be more sanguine than she is. I rapidly change the way I impress her, so that she does not have to hurry from one impression to another on her own. She has to match my pace. This changes the situation, and she eventually tires of it and gives up. Between my sanguine impressions on the child and her rush from one thing to another, according to her temperament, a more harmonious condition is gradually established in her as a natural response. So I can treat the sanguine child this way. I present them with quickly changing impressions, always thinking up something new, so that, say, they first see black, then white, and thus they have to continually hurry from one thing to another. Then I get in touch with the parents and will hear from them that their children have an extraordinary love of sugar. Perhaps they are given many sweets or in some other way manage to get hold of them. Or perhaps the family as a whole loves sweet dishes. When this is not the case, then mother's milk may have been too sweet. So I explain this to the parents and advise them to put the sanguine child on a diet for a while by reducing their amount of sugar. Thus, by arranging a low-sugar diet with the parents, cooperation is established between home and school. The reduction of sugar will gradually help to overcome the abnormality that in this case is caused by an irregularity in the liver's activity in relation to gall secretions. There is a slight, barely noticeable, irregularity in the secretion of gall. Here, too, I will recognize the help from the parents. Thus we must recognize where the physical is both united and within spirit as a fact. We can go into greater detail and describe, say, a boy who is quick to comprehend and understand everything easily, but after a few days, when I review what he grasped so quickly and about which I was so pleased, it has vanished. Again, in this case, I can do much at school to improve the situation. I will try to explain something to the boy that requires more concentration than he is used to. He is able to understand things too quickly, and he doesn't need to exert enough inner effort, so what he learns may not make a strong enough impression on him. Thus I give him some hard nuts to crack. I give him something more difficult to understand, requiring greater attention. I can do this at school. Again, I contact the child's parents, and I may hear various things from them. What I am saying will not be true of every case, but I want to give some idea of a path to pursue. I will have a tactful discussion with the parents, avoiding any hint of arrogance by not talking down to them when giving instructions. Through our conversation, I discover how the family eats, and I will most likely discover that this child eats too many potatoes. This situation is a little difficult, because they might tell me that whereas their child may eat too many potatoes, the neighbor's little daughter eats even more, and she doesn't have the same problems. Thus, the trouble cannot be caused by eating potatoes. Something like this is what a parent might say. Nevertheless, the problem does arise from eating potatoes, because children's bodies differ from one another, one being able to assimilate more potatoes than another. The strange thing is that the condition of one child shows that too many potatoes are consumed. It is shown by the fact that the memory is not functioning as it should. In this case, however, the remedy is not fewer potatoes, though it may lead to some improvement. But after a while, matters are no better than before. An immediate reduction of potatoes does not lead to the desired effect. Rather, it is a matter of breaking a habit gradually through some activity. So, we suggest that the parents give the child a little less potatoes the first week, a little less for the second week, and so on, so that the child is becoming accustomed to eating only small amounts of potatoes. In this case, it is a question of breaking a habit, and here we see the healing effect that can be induced by this means. Idealists are very likely to criticize anthroposophy and argue that it is materialistic, and they actually do this. For example, if an anthroposophist says that a child who comprehends easily but fails to retain the material should gradually eat fewer potatoes, people will accuse that person of being an absolute materialist. Nevertheless, there is such an intimate interaction between matter and spirit that we cannot work effectively unless we can penetrate matter with spiritual perception and master it through spiritual knowledge. It is really unnecessary to say how greatly such things are slandered in today's society. But if teachers are open to a worldview that reveals broad vistas, they come to understand these things. One's outlook merely needs to be extended. For example, when you realize how little sugar is consumed in Russia compared to the amount in England, it will help you understand children. And if you compare the Russian and English temperaments, you can easily understand the effect of sugar on one's temperament. It is useful to understand the world because such knowledge can assist us in everyday tasks. Now I will add this. In Baden, Germany, there is a remarkable monument that honors Drake. I wanted to know what was so special about this particular Drake, so I looked it up in an encyclopedia and read, quote, "In Offenburg, a monument was erected in memory of Sir Francis Drake, because it was erroneously believed that he had introduced potatoes into Europe," unquote. There it is, in black and white. So a memorial was erected in honor of this man, because he supposedly introduced potatoes to Europe. He didn't, but he has a memorial in Offenburg anyway. The potato was introduced into Europe fairly recently. Now, I will tell you something, and you can laugh as much as you like, but it is the truth, nevertheless. One can study how the development of human intelligence is recorded from well before there were potatoes until their introduction. And, as you know, potatoes are used in alcohol distilleries. Thus, potatoes suddenly played an important role in the development of Europeans. If you compare the increase in the use of potatoes with the development of intelligence, you find that compared to people today, those living before the time of potatoes had a less detailed understanding of things, but what they were able to grasp was retained. They tended to conserve knowledge which was deeply inner. After the introduction of the potato, people began to comprehend things more quickly, but it was not retained because knowledge did not sink in deeply enough. The history of intellectual development runs parallel to eating potatoes. So again, we can see how spiritual science explains this in a material way. People everywhere can learn much about cultural history if they would only realize how the physical takes hold of the spiritual in human subconsciousness. This is easy to see in the nature of human desires. Let us take the example of a man who has to write a great deal. Every day he has to write newspaper articles, and he feels a need to chew on his pen when trying to meet his deadlines. If you have been through this yourself, you can talk about it, but no one has a right to criticize others unless one speaks from personal experience. While pondering and biting a pen, one feels a need for coffee, since coffee helps one's thoughts cohere. Thinking becomes more logical when one drinks coffee. Journalists must enjoy coffee, because if they do not drink it, their work requires more from them. By contrast, consider a diplomat. Just recall the diplomats before the World War and what they had to acquire. They had to use their legs in a special approved way. In the society in which they moved, they had to learn how to glide rather than step firmly as ordinary people do. And their thoughts had to become somewhat fleeting and fluid. Diplomats who have logical minds will most likely fail in that profession and be unsuccessful in their efforts to help the nations resolve problems. When diplomats are together, one does not say they are having coffee, but that they are having tea. At such times, there is a need for one cup of tea after another, so that the interchange of thoughts does not proceed in logical sequence, but arises so far as possible from one idea to the next. This is why diplomats love to drink tea. Tea releases one thought from the next. It makes thinking fluid and fleeting and destroys logic. So we may say that writers tend to love coffee and diplomats tend to love tea. And in both cases, the instinct is appropriate. If we know this, we shall not see it as an infringement on human freedom. Logic is obviously not a product of coffee, but a subconscious aid. The soul remains free. When we are considering children, it is especially helpful to look into relationships such as these, as when we say that tea is the drink of diplomats, coffee the drink of writers, and so on. We are also able gradually to gain an understanding of the effects produced by the potato. It places great demands on the digestion. Moreover, very small, almost homeopathic doses come from the digestive organs and go into the brain. This homeopathic dose is nonetheless very potent. It stimulates the forces of abstract intelligence. At this point, I may be permitted to reveal something else. If we examine the substance of a potato through a microscope, we see a well-known form of carbohydrate. And if we observe the astral body of one who has eaten a large portion of potatoes, we notice that in the area of the brain, a little over an inch behind the forehead, the potato substance becomes active there, forming uniform eccentric circles. The movements of the astral body become similar to the substance of the potato, and the potato eater becomes exceptionally intelligent, bubbling with intelligence, but it is transient and does not last. So if you concede that a human being possesses spirit and soul, it is completely foolish and fantastic to speak of spirit in images from the sensory world. Those who always want to speak of spirit in abstract terms present nothing truly spiritual. It is quite the contrary in the case of those who are able to bring spirit down to earth through pictures related to the senses. Such individuals can say that when someone bubbles with intelligence, potato substance forms in the brain, but in a spiritual sense. In this way, we learn to recognize subtle and delicate differentiations and transitions. We discover that tea affects logic by making a cleavage between thoughts, but it does not stimulate thinking. By saying that diplomats have a predilection for tea, we do not imply that they can produce thoughts. On the other hand, potatoes do stimulate thoughts. They shoot thoughts upward like lightning, only to let them vanish. But along with this swift upsurge of thoughts, which can also take place in children, there is a parallel process that undermines the digestive system. In children whose digestive system is upset this way, leading to complaints of constipation, we see that all kinds of useless, though clever, thoughts shoot up into their heads, thoughts that they certainly lose again, but were, nevertheless, there. I mention these things in detail so you can see how the soul and the physical body must be seen as a whole unity, and how, in the course of human development, a condition must be brought about again that can hold together the most varied of cultural streams. Today we are living in a time when body and soul are completely separated from each other. We can see this clearly when we are able to look more deeply into the history of human evolution. Today we separate religion, art, and science. The guardians of religion do everything in their power to prevent any encroachment by science into religion. They argue that religion is a matter of faith, and science belongs elsewhere. In science, nothing is based on faith, everything is based on knowledge. In order to succeed in separating them this way, spirit is cut off from science, and the world is cut off from religion. The result is that religion becomes abstract, and science eliminates spirit. And art is completely emancipated. Today there are those who, if you say something about the supersensory world, assume an air of intelligent superiority and consider you to be superstitious, as though saying, quote, "You poor fool, we know that this is all pure nonsense," unquote. But then a Bjornsen or someone writes something in which spiritual matters play a role. Footnote, Bjornsen, more or less, 1832 to 1910, Norwegian writer, editor, and theater director, known with Henrik Ibsen, Alexander Kielland, and Jonas Lie as one of the four great ones of 19th century Norwegian literature. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1903. End footnote. Something like this is then introduced into art, and everyone runs after it and enjoys a kind of knowledge in the arts that was otherwise rejected. Superstition can appear in strange guises. I once had an acquaintance who was a dramatist. Parenthesis, concrete examples should certainly be included when speaking of the art of education, which can be learned only from life. Parenthesis. One time I met him in the street. He was running very quickly and perspiring. It was 3 minutes before 8 o'clock in the evening. I asked him where he was going in such a hurry. In his hurry, he could only say that he must rush to the post office, which closed at 8 o'clock. I did not detain him, but psychologically I was interested in the reason for his haste, so I waited until he returned. After a while he came back in a great heat, and he was more talkative. I asked him why he was in such a hurry to catch the post, and he said, quote, "I have just sent off my play," unquote. He had always said that this play was not yet finished, and he said the same thing now, quote, "It's true that the play is still unfinished, but I especially wanted to send it off today, so that the director would receive it tomorrow. I just wrote him a letter to say as much, and asked him to be sure to send it back. You see, if a play is sent off before the end of the month, it may be chosen for a performance. Otherwise, there is no chance." Unquote. This dramatist was an extremely enlightened and intelligent man. Nevertheless, he believed that if a play was dispatched on a certain day, it might be accepted, even if it had to be returned because it was unfinished. This incident shows you how things that people are likely to despise creep into some hole from which they raise their heads at the very next opportunity. This is especially true of children. We think we have managed to rid them of something, but then there it is again, somewhere else. We must learn to watch for this. We must open our hearts when studying the human being so that a true art of education can be established on our understanding of the human being. Only by going into details can we fathom all these issues. As I was saying today, religion, art, and science are spoken of as though they were entirely unrelated. This was not the case in the ancient past of human evolution, when they were completely united. Then there were mystery centers, which were also centers for education and culture, centers dedicated to the cultivation of religion, art, and science. Knowledge then was presented in pictures and mental images of the spirit world. They were received in an intuitive and comprehensive way that transformed them into outer physical symbols, and these formed the basis of ceremonial cults. Science was embodied in those cults, as was art. Anything taken from the realm of knowledge and given outer form must be beautiful. Thus, in those times, divine truth, a moral goodness, and a sensory perceptible beauty existed in the mystery centers as a unity of religion, art, and science. Only later did this unity split to become science, religion, and art, each existing in and of itself. Today this separation has reached its culmination. Things that are essentially united have become divided through the course of cultural development. Human nature is such, however, that for us it is a necessity to experience the three as a unity and not see them as separate. People can experience the unity of religious science, scientific religion, and artistic ideality. Otherwise, they are inwardly torn apart. Consequently, wherever this differentiation has become most intense, it is imperative to rediscover the connection between these three areas. And we will see in our teaching how we can bring art, religion, and science to children as a unity. We will see how children respond in a living way to this unification of religion, art, and science, because they are in harmony with their own inner nature. This is why I have repeatedly pointed out, in no uncertain terms, that we must work to educate children through the knowledge that they are in fact beings with aesthetic potential. We should neglect no opportunity to demonstrate how during their first years children experience religion naturally and instinctively. All these things, the harmonious unification of religion, art, and science, must be understood in the right way, and their value recognized in the teaching methods that we will discuss further. The end of Lecture 7.